Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs
a little deeper.
I'm trying to go for like horror, but you know, I got a couple of months to work on it. Hey.
Yeah, it's not October yet.
We got a great show in store for you, as I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Harold Williams.
That doesn't even make any sense unless you've seen this movie.
It'll make sense when we start the conversation.
Will it? Sheesh. Because I don't feel like it will.
We just recently got back from the theater of seeing the latest movie, the latest horror film, actually, for this year so far, and that is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. So stick around as we dive into that conversation. We got a lot to say, and I'm interested if Spencer messed himself or we had a good time in the movie. So
I guess you're gonna have to wait and find out. The Filmlosophers podcast magically appears for your auditory delight by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. Each Wednesday morning, first check for any dead bodies, then question why you're still living in the same place. Then head on over and download the latest episode on your favorite streaming platforms such as Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. Hopefully you're more successful in the latter than the former.
That's really great judging our listeners, Spencer. Good job.
I'm worried about our listeners. Get out. It's not a good setup. You don't need a cursed book to tell you how to find us. Connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. We promise we won't bite.
Well, Spencer might, but
I won't. That's unhygienic. Finally, conquer your inner and outer demons and check out our entire list of episodes at filmlosophers.com.
That's right. We got over 170 episodes, and we are still ticking. We are moving, and we are dropping information for you as the weeks go by. We just actually had a great opportunity at Oblivion Comics and Coffee here in Sacramento. Great trivia night. We want to throw a shout out to everybody who was there, who won, because we gave out some really awesome prizes. And so stick around and listen in as more things come about and we announce newer and cooler stuff to come out of the Filmlosophers.
Yeah, I like doing cool stuff. We should do it more often.
That's right. But speaking of cool stuff, that brings us to the conversation we are having today, and that is the the conversation about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. This movie, in all honesty, has been one of those movies that I have been anticipating all year long, ever since it was first announced. And, I mean, needless to say, I'm excited that it's here. And I'm excited that we're going to get a chance to talk about it. That's not saying it was good or bad. I'm not giving away anything yet. I'm just saying I'm excited to talk about it. So, before we dive into this conversation, Spencer, give him that synopsis goodness.
It's 1968 in America. Change is blowing in the wind, but seemingly far removed from the unrest in the cities is the small town of Mill Valley, where for generations the shadows of the Bellows family has loomed large. It's in their mansion on the edge of town that Sarah, a young girl with horrible secrets, turned her tortured life into a series of scary stories, written in a book that has transcended time. Stories that have a way of becoming all too real for a group of teenagers who discover Sarah's terrifying tome.
Directed by Andre Overdell and screenwritten by the illustrious, wonderful, magnanimous, awesome producer Guillermo del Toro.
Well, that person had a lot of adjectives.
Oh, he did, and he has plenty more where that came from. The film stars Zoe Coletti, Michael Garza, Gabriel Rush, Austin Abrams, Dean Norris, Gil Bellows, and Lorraine Toussaint. Del Toro was quoted by SFX magazine when talking about the film that he is, as a director, he's not interested in scares. He uses horror movies more like a fairy tale. So that's actually really cool, recognizing if you're familiar with Guillermo del Toro, you know that he spends a lot of time creating, like, just unique tales that actually just really changed the whole focus of most modern horror movies. Like, you would think anything that would be exemplified as a horror movie, he turns it around and turns it more into a fairy tale. So it's very unique. Quick side note, I did miss a point. This film is based on the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark book series, published in the 1980s and written by Alvin Schwartz and illustrated by Stephen Gamell. So if you're unfamiliar, this film is actually based on a pre-existing book series. There's only three in the series, but this was a very well-known book series to most people who grew up during the 80s and 90s, and even the early 2000s. These books were the epitome of stories to tell when you're with groups of friends or whatnot. So I was a huge fan of these books. I love them, and I absolutely reread all these stories to everybody that I would see. You know, it was a really big part of my childhood, and I'll get into a little bit more about that as we go on. Also talking about Guillermo del Toro, he also, when speaking about the director, stated that the first thing you have to accomplish is the marriage of the material and the director. If you can do that right, then those discussions become fewer when talking about hard discussions when making movies. For example, if I gave this to a director who had proclivities to upsetting violence, then I'm going to be fighting that instinct during the whole production. However, I knew Andre's movies were incredibly entertaining. So when he read the screenplay for the film, he said, "Is this going to be PG-13? And we said, "Yeah." Guillermo del Toro actually compared it to as you visiting Disneyland, where he goes, "When you go to Disneyland, you don't expect to shoot off the Matterhorn and die. You scream, but you know you're going to land safely. That's what we wanted." So that's definitely the MO, if you will, for somebody as illustrious as Guillermo del Toro, somebody who is a literary genius as Mr. Del Toro. I'll stop. No, I won't. But to recognize, like, if you are new to this podcast, we've spoken highly about Guillermo del Toro several times, mostly me. And you recognize, like, a lot of his previous works, they're very much in the vein of, like, fairy tales. They are stories written from a fantastical point of view. And they're all incredibly interesting. And seeing as how this is an example of his writing being seen as that, like, fantastical fairy tale, it's an interesting take on a batch of stories, like an anthological run of stories that I used as a kid to terrorize other people with.
Not surprising.
But it's really interesting to hear, like, the process, if you will, of going about recognizing, okay, I am determined to make this particular film a PG-13 film. And you have to have a director who's willing to comply with that and focus on creating a PG-13 film as opposed to a R rating, which this could have easily slipped into that, just knowing the source material. So that's a really great insight into, like, that process, you know? Because you don't really see that often.
No, it's true. Normally people are just like, okay, let's make this an R movie and just, like, use a whole bunch of, like, torture porn to, like, get it through.
No, seriously. Real quick before we continue, the budget for this film rested at $28 million. Its domestic opening weekend, because this film just dropped, debuted at $20 million. And totals as of today on August 12th, you are looking at $23 million. So it's doing well thus far.
Yeah.
I mean, it's competing with a lot of other bigger name films that are in the theaters right now. But for it being what it is, I'm actually impressed. And most people should be. Talking about my childhood, this was one of those movies. So I really have to commend my parents for being a little bit more open-minded growing up. I grew up in a somewhat religious upbringing, or surrounded in a more rigid religious upbringing. But my parents were always encouraging me to read and find ways to read and you know, things like that. So they were the ones who allowed me to get these books. And because I was allowed to read them, but nobody else was, like, that I went to school with or I went to church with, I would be the one who would have all the stories in my mind and I would retell the stories like at the playground or whatever to all the kids.
And I'm sure you took way too much joy in doing that.
Hey, you can't take that joy away from me.
I'm not trying to, but I'm just saying it explains a lot.
But these books were a really big part of my childhood. And honestly, these particular anthological books kind of spurred the love and the joy that I have when it comes to my modern day passion for horror movies. Because these were all great stories. Like, if you ever get a chance to read through these books, they're creepy. But they're creepy in a whimsical sense where depending on the type of person you are, like, you're not going to go and have, you know, vicious nightmares or whatnot, but you are going to be left pondering and wondering and trying to make sense of what you just read because it was so unique. And mind you, we've had several things like that throughout the year. We've had several modern day anthological type pieces, whether if it's Netflix's Black Mirror. That's a great example where you have this series of shows that have no common thread, and they're all unique stories making up this complete like season. The only thing is that sometimes, like, honestly, those Black Mirror episodes get like raw and real and kind of raunchy or ridiculous. A lot of alliteration here. Like the very first episode of Black Mirror, the one about the
recording device that lets you just like rewatch any memory of things you've seen.
Well, that one was trippy, but the very, very, very first episode was the one about the pig and the prime minister. Mm. And the prime minister's daughter being abducted, so to speak.
Well, that's not the first one, because I watched the first one and it was the one I said.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I've only watched the first one, so I know which one it is.
See, now you're making me question your...
No, because like when you start Black Mirror, and that's the episode that starts playing. That's why I mentioned it.
You really think so?
Yes.
All right, we're going to put it to the test.
Okay. To the Google.
To the Google. First episode, the national anthem, the one I just said. Prime Minister Michael Callow faces a shocking dilemma when Princess Susanna, a much-loved member of the royal family, is kidnapped. You are wrong.
No.
I'm literally looking at IMDb right now. I'm literally... There's no other resource for us to look other than IMDb.
There is one other, actually.
The one you are talking about, however, is the third episode in the first season. The entire history of you? In the near future, everyone has access to memory implant that records everything they do, see, and hear.
Huh.
So, it's okay. I knew you were wrong anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
But talking about this, like I was saying, being open-minded, my parents were open-minded because of the fact that this book series, so this book, the very first one, debuted in 1981. It had a follow-up to it called More Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And that was brought about in 1984. And then they went about and created the third one, which was called Scary Stories 3, I believe. Scary Stories 3, More Tales to Chill Your Bones. And that was brought about in 1991. So by the time the third book came out, people had become, mostly parents and teachers, have been making themselves aware that this book was frequenting, you know, school libraries and public school libraries and things like that. And so it was a little bit jarring for parents who were expecting their kids to be coming home with, you know, like Paddington or Winnie the Pooh or Nancy Drew or Encyclopedia Brown or all these other books or wholesome things, you know, Boxcar Kids, whatever you want to read.
I read those.
You're not helping, Spence. But parents were expecting their kids to be coming home with books like these to read wholesome literature, and instead coming home and giving themselves nightmares or scaring themselves half to death with great stories from these books. And so I believe it was in 1994 when you had the or 1993, you had former elementary school teachers and individuals and moms and whatnot who were beginning to speak out against it, saying it's like completely inappropriate and it depicted violence and all this stuff. They even went on as to say, they said if these books were made into movies, they'd be rated R because of the graphic violence. There's no moral to them. The bad guys always win. It's a horror story. There's not many scary stories where the actual main good guy wins. It's kind of the nature of horror. that's just kind of the aim. Like, if it wasn't a horror film, if it wasn't where the good guy always won, then, or if there was no ambiguity as to whether or not the good guy won or not, then it wouldn't necessarily be horror. It would be more in like the sci-fi or the thriller, or even like something to that effect, like the action thriller or whatnot. Most of the time, most horror films, you're left feeling helpless as the main antagonist all the way up until the end. So, but it's interesting that this was the focus, if you will, for a lot of people who were wanting to ban it. Parents, people. It was right up there with like the video games, you know, oh, video games are too violent. Super Mario squishes, you know, these poor mushrooms and turtles and what's he doing and PETA. You know, things like that were like always being brought up. So it's no surprise that this was another thing that they wanted to kind of bring to the forefront, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, do you remember hearing any of that kind of stuff back in the 90s or even 2000s?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, thankfully, neither did I. Like, I didn't hear about it. I just had the opportunity to actually read them without, you know, any confrontation, I think. I don't remember. But needless to say, fast forward all the way to 2019, and we are now in a place where these films have now been made, these books have been now made into a major motion film. And the fact that it's been made gives us the opportunity to see it and recognize if this is a film worthy of, you know, rewarding or condemning. And I say that because of the fact that there are so many different things that are going on nowadays. I mean, we got so many different adaptations out there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's making books into movies and comic books into movies. And the difficult thing about this one is that it's an anthological book. It's like it's a collection of stories. It's not like a narrative running through the entire, you know, run of all the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Halloween. No, not Halloween. What? Trick or Treat.
No.
Never saw Trick or Treat. What about Crash?
No.
Of course not.
Well, okay. Like, so when you were telling me about this, I assumed it was going to be something similar to, like, Are You Afraid of the Dark? Where, like, there's, like, this over, like, you know, story and, like, these mini stories are connected to, like, a main story in, like, a really insignificant way.
Well, like, So we'll get into like the whole idea of like the base storyline and the beginning storyline, like and if they are necessary to have each other in them.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get into that in a little bit. But first, let's talk about expectations. Before going into the movie, what was your first thought, Spence, before you actually saw the film?
Well, like I just said, I thought it was going to be kind of like an Are You Afraid of the Dark episode.
Uh-huh.
And other than that, I didn't really have much of an opinion because I don't really go to see horror movies because usually I find them predictable and I'm like, don't go into the garage, you know, he's out there type thing. And people go out into the garage. Like,
it's true.
Just lock the door and then don't bother.
It is. That's very true because like we have already stated several times on the podcast that Spencer is the forever Captain Obvious when it comes to these movies. However, there have been instances where we've seen movies where it's like, okay, that was technically somewhat of a horror movie, but it still surprised you.
Yeah, because they had good ideas and they didn't take like the easy way out.
True.
And I think that's kind of what I'm looking for is something that's creative and not lazy.
No, and that's...
Or cliche.
No, yeah. 100%. Like, which, I mean, you don't want to have those types of movies where you're like, okay, I'm expecting to see something that has already been done before. I'm just hoping it was packaged a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one thing. But to actually have an opportunity where you see a movie and you're like, okay, they're supposed to be doing something completely new. So let's hope that it actually succeeds, you know?
Yeah.
And you have big names behind it like Guillermo del Toro, and you got like a slew of great actors and actresses, and the basis of this film is in a book series that has caused more controversy than most other books nowadays. Mm. So with all those things going for it, you know, how could it go wrong? Well, exactly. That's kind of the existential question, if you will, you know?
Yeah.
Any other expectations?
No, that's about it.
That's about it. Okay. Well, like for me, like I said, I was a big fan of the book. So like, I think the biggest thing for me is the biggest expectation I had was I did not want to see another Goosebumps movie. Like, I really did not want to see another Goosebumps movie. As much as I love Jack Black, that first Goosebumps movie was rough. Like, I wasn't a fan of it.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing as how much these books, like, these were the precursor, if you will, to Goosebumps for me.
Mm-hmm.
I read these books before Goosebumps even came about, and then I started reading Goosebumps, and I had these three somewhere on the shelf somewhere. But it was, as much as Goosebumps was a part of my childhood, the fact that the film flopped so much with me hurts my soul to an extent. And so, like with this one, my biggest concern, my biggest expectation, my biggest hope was that it was not another one of those.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
So, starting off with, like, the scary story books, like, how did you, like, receive Goosebumps? Were they even scary to you as a kid or no?
They were interesting. Like, the idea of having... So, the idea of having stories that were horror in nature but not scary was feasible because of Goosebumps. Now, you take the elements of, like, okay, growing up, yes, I was bombarded with all these horror movies. I was, you know, I was allowed to watch everything from Child's Play to Nightmare on Elm Street to, you know, Halloween to Friday the 13th to everything you could think of during the 80s. I was allowed to watch as a very, 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 very young kid. And because of that, I became almost not numb, but I became appreciative of the nature of horror movies. So having that, reading Goosebumps, it was an opportunity where I could actually indulge in the horror genre without having to lose sleep over those stories, both figuratively and literally. You know, I could actually read these books. There were horror aspects of it. Like, oh my gosh, I cannot, you know, Night of the Living Dummy still gives me nightmares. You know, but the idea of Slappy, and the original Slappy, not this new cockamamie one in the Goosebumps movies.
You want to know what's interesting?
What?
Is I feel like the not Slappy from Toy Story 4 was more terrifying.
I was just going to say, I got more Goosebumps, quote unquote, from the Slappy knockoff dummies in Toy Story 4 than I did in the newer one. And it's practically a cartoon, but like the new Goosebumps movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Goosebumps never really scared me, but it was an opportunity for me to continue my you know, to satisfy my appetite for horror without overindulging, I guess. You know, I got tastes of horror in every book, but it was never so much that I got sick of it, nor was it ever to the point to where it scared me away from it. So, and that went the same thing with, like, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I literally have every episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark on Vudu. Like, every now and then, I will jump on there and be like, all right, let's binge season 4. Let's binge season 7 when, you know, that whole thing situation came back where there's actually a story now happening with the kids. Or let's, you know, season 10, the final season. Like, I have all of them on there.
Okay.
And I watch them all because those, I was a little bit older, and those had some horror elements to it. I there were certain stories in there that actually had some scary parts to it. And I loved them. They were great. So there are several parts that lead up to where I'm at now where, like, thinking of, like, anthological horror films, there are so many that I'm going to be dropping in this episode that it's like my... You can see the evolution of how I've indulged in horror over the years from a young kid all the way to now. So... Yeah, it's much like how the Goosebumps franchise, the Goosebumps books were not as scary. The scary stories to tell in the dark books, those were scary. Like those had like, not just because, and here's the creepy part about them, not just because of the stories, but because they actually had illustrations of some of these monsters in the book. Like I'm watching this movie and I'm like, oh my God, I remember that one. I remember that one.
Yeah, I think, I know I didn't read these as a child, but I think I might have flipped through it because there was one monster in this movie. I was like, this looks vaguely familiar.
I mean, it's for me, there was like, it was interesting, like revisiting old friends that I hadn't seen in a while. In
old
terms
friends?
Of, well, because I used to read, I used to read these books like all the time. They were worn out by the time I like got older and I had to get rid of them. So, you know, but like in terms of that, that's where I saw it as. And it was all a part of this, you know, learning to love and appreciating the genre for what it really is, which it's an opportunity to create a level ground, if you will, for your villain and your hero. It creates a even playing field for the overpowered and the over evil. You know, you become one with everything and nobody is above others. So, yeah. But I guess jumping into the film, like first impressions after the film, what was your first thought? Because we left the theater and I'm like, I really don't want to hear anything from you, Spencer, yet, because I know I want to give you a chance to gather your thoughts and then I want to hear it on the episode. So this is actually the first time I'm hearing anything from Spencer about this movie. So lay it on me.
Okay.
First impressions.
I did have a problem with how the movie ended because it ended on like, we're doing this. And I'm like, wait, what? How? Like, you've learned things through this movie. I'll give you that.
Uh-huh.
But you didn't learn what you're trying to attempt to do now. So I want to come back to the end of the movie at some point. But overall, I was actually pretty impressed that they, one, didn't do, you know, just like a whole bunch of connected mini stories.
Yeah,
I was actually pretty happy about that, and like all the stories like connect to like the larger thing. It actually worked really well, so I was actually pretty impressed with this movie.
Yeah, I have to admit my biggest concern was that the connectivity, because this wasn't just going to be an anthological film, this was going to be one consistent storyline through and through, with all these short stories having highlights throughout the film. And like I said, that scared me because i.e. Goosebumps,
right?
The movie,
fair.
Not the TV series, the movie. And so with that said, like I didn't want to deal with losing out on an opportunity to enjoy this film because of the fact that they chose to do something that was just wrong. Like creating a storyline that was completely unnecessary. And that's the big question. Like that is the bigger overarching question. Like, when it comes to creating films like this, you have your anthological films. You have your films that have like short stories that make up the whole. And then you have your films that have the stories peppered throughout the main narrative. So take, for instance, I was thinking about this on the way over here. Take, for instance, you have films like, oh my gosh. I am completely drawing a blank.
He's blanking.
Like, oh my God, there's Creepshow. Creepshow, George A. Romero's Creepshow, back in the 1970s. That movie was essentially just anthological stories as this ghoulish, you know, demon, if you will, or this caretaker is rummaging through these stories, these like comic books from Creepshow. And you're introduced to story after story. Or, that opportunity to see that movie, it was interesting and it worked. And then you get stuff like the Tales from the Dark Side movie, which I don't know if you've ever seen Tales from the Dark Side from the 80s, had a great cast of characters. None of the stories actually connect to the main story, but the main story is actually interesting. It's essentially this suburban housewife, this suburban woman, who comes home, looks like she just came straight from work and then the grocery store, and she gets home and she has this, you think everything's normal, and she has this little boy locked in a dungeon-like jail in her kitchen, and she's planning to cook the little boy for a supper for witches by the end of the evening. And he ends up distracting her by reading her all these stories from this book that she gave him, thinking he would like it. He starts distracting her by reading her all these stories from it, and it ends really funny and really good. Like, he ends up breaking out and pushing her into the oven, and she ends up going into the oven, and he's like, hey, cool. but things like that. And then you have, so those are like separated stories. The stories are on its own. The base narrative, which is the story that kind of started the film and ends the film, they are completely disconnected from the overarching, you know, mini stories, the other things, the main meat, if you will, of the film.
Hmm.
But then you fast forward and you get things like one of my favorite Halloween movies, Trick or Treat by Michael Dougherty. Trick or Treat is this movie that is so well done, and it takes place over the course of just one Halloween evening, and it's just remarkable. Got like actors like Brian Cox and Anna Paquin when she was younger, and it's just jam-packed with all these people, and the story thread that runs from the beginning to the end is a part of every single story, but it's told so well, it's beautiful. I'm almost crying. No, I swear,
oh,
I'm not.
Gosh.
But so, like, having that in mind, like, my concern was this going to be a story that had threads through all the stories and connected them with a main storyline? Or was it going to be like, oh, we're sitting here, we're talking about this, and these stories are going to happen? Like,
yeah,
I don't know if you ever saw any of the VHS movies. VHS
so.
1, 2, or 3, or even the ABCs of Death. There's a 1 and 2 of those. Essentially, those are films where something's happening in the back end, but there's like they're watching these VHS tapes and these videos pop up, and those are the short films. Like, those are the little pieces of story. Mm. Same thing with the ABCs of Death. They took all these incredible directors and they gave each of them a letter and told them to attribute it to some way or form to death and create a short film out of it. And it was really great. It was really fantastic. And they made two of those. But those had nothing to do with, like, an overarching narrative. So that was the question going in, how it was going to succeed as that film. And thankfully, like you said, it does work.
Yeah.
It really does, because instead of me worrying about, like, oh, they're going to ruin this story or they're not going to do that story justice or whatever, like, every single instance, it felt like, you know what it felt like? It felt like a grown-up Goosebumps movie.
Yeah. No, I could understand it, yeah.
Because, like, you actually have moments of peril. You actually lose people. People die in this movie. I don't remember a single person who's ever died in any, unless they were already dead, mind you, who had ever died in either a Goosebumps book or the movie itself. Like, I mean, obviously.
Goosebumps, no.
But that's what this thing does. It's a great way to tell these stories through an okay narrative. Like, the narrative isn't as strong as I would like, but I really have to admit that I think the overall film worked for me, you know? And that kind of goes back to, like, recognizing, you know, how are you making a film? Like, are you making a film that is one singular story, like, okay, we're doing another Hunger Games movie, you know, or like, you know, another Game of Thrones, you know, series, or they're doing another Lord of the Rings series on Amazon. And those are all based on single narrative books. Like, there's one storyline, an overarching, you know, thread that works through this entire film, through this entire story. How do you take something that has been pieced out together and make it work with a solid narrative that runs through it? And to be honest, I didn't think it was going to be feasible, even though you had Guillermo del Toro behind it. God, you know, don't hurt me, Mr. Del Toro. But, like, even with him behind it, I was worried that this film was going to fall flat because of the fact that you're doing something that nobody has really succeeded in being consistent with, or actually, like, knocking it out of the park. Minus one person who got lightning in a bottle with it. Talking about Michael Dougherty with, you know, Trick or Treat.
Right.
So, needless to say, I was very impressed. However, there were certain aspects of the film that I was kind of a little disappointed in. You know, like, you take the cast and crew. You have a lot of kids. I'm not, to be honest, I don't really know where most of those kids are from. Did you recognize anybody?
I thought I recognized one kid, but I think I just confused them for someone else. So, no.
Oh, well, I honestly couldn't see or recognize any of them. Like, there was a kid who looked like the main guy from, what did I call it? Oh, How I Met Your Mom? How I Met Your Mom, How I Met Your Mother. They're all the same thing.
Yes, but people will just light up the Facebook.
Well, let them. Let them come. But, like, you got all these people, and I don't know where any of them came from. And mind you, that's not a bad thing, because bringing in sometimes unknown people, you can strike gold with it. Like, honestly. But you have somebody like these guys, and I guess the kids were okay, but they weren't great. Like, am I kind of just going on, or does that make any sense to you?
About the characters?
Yeah.
Well,
like the performances themselves.
They were fine. Like, I like the main girl a lot.
The main girl?
Yeah. I'm so bad with names.
Trust me, I feel you on that completely.
Zoe, who played Stella.
Oh, Zoe Cutella, yeah.
Yeah, I liked her. The guy who played Ramon was pretty good, but then everyone else kind of is real background-ish.
Yeah, I mean, even the...
Even, like, you know, your second-tier characters who are, like, the best friends to Stella, they still felt like serious background characters.
Sadly, it's true because of the fact that, like, I don't think anybody in it was... Nobody in the movie could really step out and, like, shine more so than anybody else, in my opinion. Like the main character, Zoe Coletti, she really does a great job of, you know, exuding this, you know, this sense of, like, ownership of guilt and wanting to still belong and creating friends that only understand you and having that, like, dynamic and that community.
Right.
But at the same time, like, she blew it out of the park, but everyone else was like, eh. And there were even times, like, sadly, like, some of the audio dubbing didn't seem to fit with, like, the way they were talking or the way they were trying to emote, you know, emotion. So it kind of fell a little flat when it came to certain performances. Obviously, everybody can scream. Anybody can scream. So the screaming and the more horrific parts, those were fine. The idea, however, of the characters kind of having, like, heart-to-hearts or understandings like that or whatever, or even just acting like kids. I don't know how most of these people were, but it kind of seemed like a stretch for some of them to act like kids.
I was actually trying to find ages of people because I was like, I don't know if all of this adds up correctly.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not nitpicking at the film. I don't want anybody to, like, you know, scream into the episode and be like, what are you talking about? This movie was great, blah, blah, blah. No, like, I appreciated everything about the film. I appreciated its storyline and its execution of the parts that pertain to the actual stories. The thread, however, could have needed a little bit more tightening. The main thread, the story thread that ran through it all. I felt like that could have used a little bit more tightening, because I loved the idea of what this film is about, like how this storyline connects these short stories to the overarching plot and them trying to figure out a way to stop this evil spirit from killing the rest of their friends. And it's a great idea for a story, for a compilation of stories, if you will, a whole book to be presented. Because now you have a singular person who is writing these stories, as opposed to, like, oh, well, these stories are doing this. And they, like, in the Goosebumps movies, there were two. In the Goosebumps movies, they bring in Jack Black as the author, quote, R.L. Stine, you know, slap in his face. But, you know, they bring him in to do that, and it doesn't necessarily work well because of the fact that you have Jack Black playing this character who he doesn't really feel like, I don't feel like he connected with. Like, the idea of him making these stories and being this, like, short, portly, you know, author who's supposed to be this horror genius, and he's, like, fumbling all over the place, and they make it comedic, it doesn't make sense. But in this movie, you have this tortured young girl who ends up dying and comes back to create these stories that end up killing the people that are killing people in the town.
Mm-hmm.
That has merit to it. Like, oh my gosh, there is a demonic or evil spirit thing or whatever that is creating the stories and enacting them. And they're not just stories. They are folklore tales to the individuals that they're happening to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has a personal connection to each story that happens. Because, so just so it explains, each story that is presented to our main characters is a story about one of the individuals in the group. Think of it like a kid's version of Final Destination.
That's, you know, surprisingly accurate.
Yeah, like, you know who it's going to be, and you are actually read line for line what's going to happen to them as they're, you know, they get attacked. But the stories themselves pay a special attention and pay a special homage to that person's life by it being based in either their own history or their own life, you know, or their own folklore. You know, like, there's a great instance where one of the individuals who gets attacked, he's attacked by a woman who is obviously dead, and she's crying through the hallways, you know, asking, you know, where's my toe? You know, what did you do to my toe? And the thing is that the kid at the beginning doesn't believe that it's happening. He's like, oh, my dad used to tell me that story when I was a kid. Well, you come to find out the dad left long ago. Like, it's not implicitly said, but through the conversation he has with his mom right before, the dad's not in the picture. She's dating some guy. And so you don't know how long the dad's been gone, but the dad has been missing. And so to hear him say something like, oh yeah, my dad used to tell me that story when I was a kid, that ghost story when I was a kid, blah, blah, blah. That connects, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they do that with a lot of the characters in the film. So I think that was really smart storytelling on Mr. Guillermo del Toro's part.
Oh my God.
You know? But it's really smart, because then you create an instance where you allow not only an opportunity where your main characters are going to get creatively killed or made disappear, but you're given an opportunity to create, to visually see and hear this connection that these people have with the story that's being enacted. It's like your first story that you know, your first experience, Spencer, it's like your first experience on learning how to ride a bike, and then somebody turning that experience and making it out to be your demise. You know, enacting that to become your demise. That's kind of how this worked out. And it's very almost intimate. It's very poetic, so to speak, in utilizing that as a form of how to eliminate everyone else in the film.
Mm. Yeah. I'll agree with that, because, I don't know, some of those stories were actually pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the toe one, because that was like when that one was happening, I was like, okay, how would I get out of this? Like, it was like, maybe the solution was to grab the toe and being like, here's your toe back. You don't have to murder anybody today.
No, I don't think that'll work.
Hey, you never know unless you try, which you did not.
I don't want to try.
Hey, I don't know how to deal with supernatural entities. You gotta start making deals where you can. No, but like, I think.
Excuse me, Mr. Monster. Could you postpone killing me today for next week?
No, they're like, hey, where's my toe? Where's my? I have it here. I don't know who put this in the stew, but they're jerks, and I am offended for you. Like, be on their side.
Okay, horror SJW, take it easy. Like, I stand for equality with monsters. I don't know what you're talking about, but I know you deserve to be treated equal.
Exactly. Why are they monsters? Maybe that's why, because nobody ever sides with
excuse
them.
Excuse me, that is an offensive term. We go by the visual grotesque now. We're not monsters. We are visually grotesque. If you...
Oh man. Okay, but like, no, seriously, I really did like a few of those side stories. Especially the Red Room one.
Yeah.
Like that was an interesting twist on the whole building turned red.
I was thinking about it. So the so just in case you don't know, the design of that particular monster is dead on. Like one in the picture.
That one was the one where I'm like, I feel like I've seen this somewhere.
Which I'm pretty sure we're gonna use that for our episode art, so you'll know what we're talking
about.
Cool. But yeah, that one was really interesting because the monster's face, much like in the actual story or in the book, it looks like what's the best way to put it?
It looks like if you walk down a hall and you saw something like that coming to you, you just go, nope, and run the other way.
Nope.
That's what it is.
Nope. But then it was interesting because he was being like, you know, coming back. Like, they were coming at him from all sides. It was really great. And the way they made the monster look was spot on like the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because the design of that creature's face looked very similar to a short film I saw not too long ago, where the short film was essentially this Japanese executioner to the emperor was going to behead an enemy to the empire. And as he's getting ready to do it, the guy who's going to be beheaded ends up making a silly face and begins to make the executioner try to break. Like trying to make him laugh. And the executioner is sweating bullets, and every time he continues to look back at the guy he's going to behead, his face becomes more and more cartoonish. And it ultimately turns into like this thing where it just becomes so over the top cartoonish, like it's like a prosthetic over his face, much like the character that we saw. It looked like a very exaggerated caricature of a man's face who can't keep his composure. And the executioner is literally on the verge of, like, breaking. Because if he breaks, then it's obviously his life because he can't be professional. Mm. But the design of this creature reminded me a lot of how the dynamic for that particular film, how the character kind of began to change over and whatnot. It was really well done. And all the stories in this film were absolutely beautiful. Between the one with the red room to the one with the one about the toe, the scarecrow, Harold. I mean, if anybody's anybody, if you remember any story from the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, you remember the story of Harold. That usually gave me nightmares quite often.
So is that like how the story actually went in the book?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So, look, that's the actual creature from the book. So that's
no, thank you at all.
And then Harold wasn't too far off either.
Oh yeah, these are actually really well done in like how they were able to translate that, especially that other one, because just looking at that drawing you would not be like, oh yeah, we can definitely do this.
Oh yeah, no, this was something that honestly, if you look at the books and then you look at the actual movie, you're like, oh, this is...
Yeah, there's a picture of the movie right there.
Yeah, well, there's a picture of the movie right there.
So terrifying.
And then, yeah, I mean, but it's incredible. And you have to appreciate that. And whoever worked on the design, not set design, but like...
The costumes
and the special effects and
really
all that.
Really good.
Like, kudos to you, dude. Like, you are the man. Or woman. That's not... I'm not, you know, big... Yeah. Just saying.
Mm.
Don't do that. Like, but all that to say, one of the things you have to ask yourself when it comes to movies like this is, does the beginning and end narrative, does it take away or does it add to the individual stories that are being peppered throughout this film? Because nobody's coming to see this movie for the narrative that runs through it. They're coming to see the short stories that make up the little parts of it, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself, you know, when does it get to a point to where a movie that has a narrative like that, you have to ask, does it add or does it detract? Is it necessary or does it need to be tossed out? You know? And like I said, this is a Goosebumps bashing kind of episode, but like you take Goosebumps, for instance, had it been just an anthological film, like somebody said, okay, we're going to do a Goosebumps movie and we want these great directors to do 5-minute short films on some of their favorite books, I would have probably liked that. You know, you take great directors, maybe some awesome actors who loved the books growing up, and you're like, all right, let's do this real quick. Let's do a Night of the Living Dummy, or let's do Monster Blood, or let's do all these different ones.
We're talking about some classic stuff right
there. Oh, dude. And all these ones. And if you would have taken that model, which that model was done, like I said, by ABCs of Death, and it was done really well.
Mm.
If you take that model and you apply it to some of these books, like, say, Goosebumps, it probably would have hit it out of the park and you probably would have had a more successful film.
Mm.
Maybe. Who knows? What do we end up with when it comes to this film? Is the main narrative necessary for the film, or could it be tossed out? You know, and I think I can honestly say, you know, I think the narrative works with this film.
Mm-hmm.
I think the narrative that runs through that is smart. I think it's very much. It's funny. I was reading an article about Guillermo del Toro, which I do every day. I was reading an article about...
I must find my daily Guillermo del Toro article.
You're not on that email list yet?
No.
But there, I was reading an article and he was like, I wanted to create a film. He's like, ultimately, I wanted to write a film that wasn't just the type of horror movie that was like, okay. He's like, because when I made... He was telling him, when I made Hellboy, I was like, this is going to be a great movie and all the kids who want to see it will be able to enjoy it 10 years from now. Like, thinking like, okay, it wasn't going to work out for everybody, but it did work out for everybody. And he began to push for, with this film, he wanted to make a horror movie that obviously, first off, was nostalgic to everybody who were fans of the book prior, but also a film that you could, if it worked, you could possibly watch it with your family. You know, in certain instances. Obviously not the younger crowd, because the younger crowd would probably lose their marbles. But like the more little older, like the young adult age, the preteen teenagers out there, this is a movie that could definitely be a first stepper for those that are wanting to get into horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I said, it's a really well done movie. I do have to say, I think I have to admit, like, this movie surprised me, and I'm happy about it, because honestly, I spent, like I mentioned earlier, I did spend a large portion of the year worried about whether or not this film was going to be a bomb or a success.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think I can definitively say, you know, it was a success to me. In terms of them executing this film with a narrative through it and the short stories being a part of it. Now, here's the bigger question I have for you, Spence. Do you think... No, have you seen Pan's Labyrinth?
No.
Okay. Well, Guillermo del Toro is known for creating certain movies, and sometimes he'll leave them on cliffhangers, but won't intend to create a follow-up.
Mm.
Like, take, for instance, Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim was made with him, but he didn't want to come back to do the sequel. There wasn't any interest to him, for him to do the sequel.
Yeah.
And then someone else did it, and it was garbage.
Yeah. No, I was there for that. It was terrible, and he had the right idea.
Do you think this film will get a sequel?
Well, see, here's the thing. There's other stories they could do.
True.
So the door's open for that, especially with the ending of this movie.
Which we're not going to give away. This is a spoiler-free episode.
I really want to talk about it. Because, like, it just introduces so many questions in the last 60 seconds of the film.
Tell you what. Why don't we discuss that in our latest extra credit episode that we'll be dropping this weekend?
Yeah, so, let's do that. Okay.
So we'll definitely talk about spoilers then. So okay. Just so you know, be on the lookout for our latest episode of Extra Credit, and we'll probably be touching on this in our conversation.
I'm glad this lined up. Okay. So sequel. I feel like I'd be scared if it fell into the same realm as Pacific Rim.
I agree.
I feel like if he doesn't like want to come back for it, leave it dead is really what I would say. But if he thinks he can come up with like a good scenario for what they're trying to accomplish in a secondary film, then I'd be willing to check it out.
So you're saying if he returns to do it?
Yes, basically. Okay. Like that's the whole hinge right now.
Honestly, I think knowing him, mm-hmm. I think he will be opposed to it.
Right.
But you do bring up a great point in that they are going to, they do still have plenty of material to work with. So it's interesting. Like, I'd like to see more, but I don't want to see it in the wrong hands.
Right.
You know, and I don't want to see, like you said, much like in the vein of, you know, where it's been before, I don't want to see it fall flat again.
Yeah, but, like, they could do a second movie with, like, slightly different storytelling and come up with, like, a slightly stronger movie than what this was. Not that it was bad by any sense, but...
Well, let's see. Let's hope that that it actually... If they do end up doing it, that it does land back in his hands and he is a big part of the vision going forward.
More so than...
Pacific Rim Uprising. Yes. So with that said, let's go ahead and go across the table. Spence, does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Film easily passes. You know, it's a pretty enjoyable watch. There's no real, like, torture porn in this at all, or, like, super gory stuff, which is always a plus, because I feel like people are always aiming for those low-hanging scare fruit.
That's true.
But as for a score, I'm thinking probably a 3.5, which is pretty good for me in, like, the horror category.
A 3.5, okay, yeah. I can see that. The film passes for me. I really did appreciate it. I actually really enjoyed it. The film is definitely a great homage to the books that came before it. And honestly, to what we should be aspiring to see when it comes to horror geared for kids.
Yeah.
You know, that is definitely something that I appreciated growing up, and I know other people will appreciate growing up nowadays, and kind of giving those open doors to a lot of the kids who want to see these movies. I would feel comfortable showing this to a preteen or a teenager. You know, one that obviously is not, you know, full too scared of, like, things like who actually has an interest in it. I'm not just going to be hey, kid, you put down your, you know, Dora the Explorer and watch this with me. Like, that's not the case.
I'm actually, like, I didn't bother to look up the rating for this movie before we watched it. I just assumed it was going to be R because, like, how often do you see, like, a good horror story aimed at, like, kids? Like, and I was shocked to see kids there. I was like, are you guys sure about this?
No, yeah.
But no, this is actually really good for kids.
So I give it a pass. And in terms of monocles, I'm going to give it a 3.5. I definitely appreciate the effort and the storyline that runs through it. I definitely appreciate every effort to make a true-to-form adaptation of the original books. And I truly appreciate the effort and the work that was put into creating these monsters and the narrative that runs through it to make a cohesive film. So a 3.5 out of me. There's still room to grow, but I'm hoping that if they do decide to create a follow-up, that room will give it time to shine, you know? So that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Remember, you can check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmphilosophy101. There you can talk to us, let us know what you thought about the film. Had you seen it? Have you not seen it? What do you think about it? Do you think Spencer should change his name to Harold? Let us know on our Facebook page or our Twitter at twitter.com/filmphilosophy101. Before we go, we want to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got the Angry Birds movie 2. Why'd they make a second one?
Gosh.
Blinded by the Light, Good Boys, and Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Nobody knows.
Okay.
So check out your local listings, or if you get a chance, check out this film. It should be in your local theaters. Get a chance to check it out. It's worth watching. So, of course, we also want to thank again, before we leave, all those who came out to show support and be a part of our summer blockbuster trivia night at Oblivion Comics and Coffee. We are super thankful for you being there.
It was awesome you guys were out.
We were so, yeah, it was so great. It was so fun, and we can't wait to have the next one with you guys. And we want to give a huge shout out to Oblivion Comics and Coffee for being so awesome. Laura and Neil, the owners, you guys rock. So,
so awesome.
Thank you again, and we can't wait for the next one to happen. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.